The Pueblo hero, Water Jar Boy, asked the question of his mother.
And then one day the boy said to his mother, and this is the great word of the quest, Mother, who is my father? She says, I don't know who your father was. He says, he says, I never went with any of the boys around here. I don't know. So he says, I'm going to find my father. And she says, you can't find your father. I know anything about him. Well, he says, I know I'm going to find him, and I'm going. And so she made him up a little lunch, and he went down to walk along the place called Horse Mesa Point, where there was a spring. And as he's approaching the spring, a man comes. He sees a man. And the man says, who are you? What are you doing here? He says, I've come. I'm looking for my father. And the man says, who's your father? Where's your father? The boy says, I think you're my father. No, says the man, I'm not your father. Yes, says the boy, I know you're my father. Then he looks at the boy, the father looks at him to scare him. That's so important. The test, the boy stands up to it, the man says, I am your father. So he takes him down into the well. This is the serpent of the well. He's the serpent power. He's called Red Water Snake, that's his name.
And he put his arm around the boy's neck. His father was very glad his boy had come, and he took him down inside the spring. In the above sample, the test is reduced to the persistent questions and a frightening look. In the earlier tale of the clam wife, the sons were tried with the bamboo knife. The hero blessed by the father returns to represent his father among men. As teacher or as emperor, his word is law. Since he is now centered in the source, to see him is to perceive the meaning of existence. From his presence, boons go out. His word is the wind of life. The hero as world redeemer. 2 degrees of initiation are to be distinguished in the mansion of the father. From the first, the son returns as emissary, but from the second, with the knowledge that I and the father are one. Heroes of this second highest illumination are the world redeemers, the so-called incarnations in the highest sense. The work of the incarnation is to refute by his presence the pretensions of the tyrant ogre. On a grandiose scale, he enacts the hero life, performs the hero deeds, slays the monster, but it is all with the freedom of a work done only to make evident to the eye what might have been accomplished equally well with a mere thought. Kans, the cruel uncle of Krishna, usurper of his own father's throne, heard a voice one day that said to him, Thy enemy is born, thy death is certain. Krishna and his older brother, Balarama, had been spirited to the cowherds from their mother's womb to protect them from this Indian counterpart of Nimrod. And he had sent demons after them, but all had been undone. Now, when his devices had failed, Kans determined to lure the youths to his city. A messenger was sent to invite the cowherds to a sacrifice and great tournament. Krishna and Balarama, his brother, went in to see the wonders of the town. There were great gardens, palaces, groves. They encountered a washerman and asked him for some fine clothes. When he laughed and refused, they took the clothes by force and made themselves very gay. Then a hump-backed woman prayed Krishna to let her rub sandal paste on his body. He went up to her, placing his feet on hers, and with 2 fingers beneath her chin, lifted her up and made her straight and fair, and he said, When I have slain Kans, I shall come back and be with you. The brothers came to the empty stadium. There the bow of the god Shiva was set up, huge as 3 palm trees, great and heavy. Krishna advanced to the bow, pulled it, and it broke with a mighty noise. Kans in his palace heard the sound and was appalled. The tyrant sent his troops to kill the brothers in the city, but the lads slew the soldiers and returned to their camp. Kans that night had ominous dreams. When he woke, he ordered the stadium prepared for the tournament and the trumpets blown for assembly. Krishna and Balarama arrived as jugglers, followed by the cowherds, their friends. When they entered the gate, there was a furious elephant ready to crush them, mighty as 10,000 common elephants. The driver rode it directly at Krishna. Balarama gave it such a blow with his fist that it halted, started back. The driver rode it again, but the 2 brothers struck it to the ground, and it was dead. The youths walked onto the field. Everybody saw what his own nature revealed to him. The wrestlers thought Krishna a wrestler. The women thought him the treasure of beauty. The gods knew him as their lord, and Kans thought he was Mara, death himself. When he had undone every one of the wrestlers sent against him, slaying finally the strongest, he leapt to the royal dais, dragged the tyrant by the hair, and killed him. Men, gods, and saints were delighted, but the king's wives came forth to mourn. Krishna, seeing their grief, comforted them with his primal wisdom. "Mother," he said, "do not grieve. No one can live and not die. To imagine oneself as possessing anything is to be mistaken. Nobody is father, mother, son. There is only the continuous round of birth and death." The legends of the Redeemer describe the period of desolation as caused by a moral fault on the part of man, Adam in the garden. Yet from the standpoint of the cosmogonic cycle, a regular alternation of fair and foul is characteristic of the spectacle of time. Just as in the history of the universe, so also in that of nations, emanation leads to dissolution, youth to age, birth to death. The God, who is the creator, becomes the destroyer in the end. From this point of view, the tyrant ogre is no less representative of the father than the earlier world emperor whose position he usurped. Stated in direct terms, the work of the hero is to slay the tenacious aspect of the father and release from its ban the vital energies that will feed the universe. In reality, slayer and dragon are of one mind behind the scenes, but mortal enemies on the stage, where the everlasting war of the gods and the titans is displayed. The hero of yesterday becomes the tyrant of tomorrow unless he crucifies himself today. The words of Krishna, the world savior, to the wives of the dead Kans carry a frightening overtone. So do the words of Jesus. "I came not to bring peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance with his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Mythology veils such ultimate revelations under half-obscuring guises. The savior figure, who eliminates the tyrant father and then himself assumes the crown, is, like Oedipus, stepping into his sire's stead. To soften the harsh patricide, the legend represents the father as some cruel uncle or usurping Nimrod. Nevertheless, the half-hidden fact remains. The son slays the father, but the son and the father are one. The hero as saint. Before we proceed to the last episode of the life, one more hero type remains to be mentioned, the saint or ascetic, the world renouncer. Thomas Aquinas, as the result of a mystical experience while celebrating Mass in Naples, put his pen and ink on the shelf and left the last chapters of his Summa Theologica to be completed by another hand. "My writing days," he stated, "are over. For such things have been revealed to me that all that I have written and taught seems of but small account to me. Wherefore I hope in my God that even as the end has come to my teaching, so it may soon come in my life." Shortly thereafter, in his 49th year, he died. Beyond life, these heroes are beyond the myth also. King Oedipus came to know that the woman he had married was his mother, the man he had slain his father. He plucked his eyes out and wandered in penance over the earth. The Freudians declare that each of us is slaying his father, marrying his mother, all the time, only unconsciously. Should the feelings chance to become aware of the real import of the world's acts and thoughts, one would know what Oedipus knew. The flesh would suddenly appear to be an ocean of self-violation. This is the sense of the legend of Pope Gregory the Great, born of incest, living in incest. Aghast, he flees to a rock in the sea and there does penance for his very life. Departure of the hero. The last act in the biography of the hero is that of the death or departure. Here, the whole sense of the life is epitomized. Needless to say, the hero would be no hero if death held for him any terror. The first condition is reconciliation with the grave. While sitting under the oak of Mamre, Abraham perceived a flashing of light and a smell of sweet odor, and turning around, he saw death coming toward him in great glory and beauty. And death said unto Abraham, Think not, Abraham, that this beauty is mine, or that I come thus to every man. Nay, but if one is righteous like thee, I thus take a crown and come to him. But if he is a sinner, I come in great corruption, and out of their sins I make a crown for my head, and I shake them with great fear, so that they are dismayed. Abraham said to him, And art thou indeed he that is called Death? He answered and said, I am the bitter name. But Abraham answered, I will not go with thee. And Abraham said to Death, Show us thy corruption. And Death revealed his corruption, showing two heads. The one had the face of a serpent, the other head was like a sword. And the servants of Abraham, looking at the fierce mane of Death, died. But Abraham prayed to the Lord, and he raised them up. As the looks of Death were not able to cause Abraham's soul to depart from him, God removed the soul of Abraham as in a dream, and the archangel Michael took it up into heaven. After great praise and glory had been given to the Lord by the angels who brought Abraham's soul, and after Abraham bowed down to worship, then came the voice of God saying thus, Take my friend Abraham into paradise, where are the tabernacles of my righteous ones, and the abodes of my saints, Isaac and Jacob in his bosom, where there is no trouble, nor grief, nor sighing, but only peace and rejoicing and life unending. The hero, who in his life represented the dual perspective, after his death is still a synthesizing image. Like Charlemagne, he sleeps only and will arise in the hour of destiny, or he is among us under another form. The life-eager hero can resist death and postpone his fate for a certain time. It is written that Cahoolan in his sleep heard a cry, so terrible and fearful that he fell out of his bed upon the ground like a sack in the east wing of the house. He rushed forth without weapons, followed by Immer, his wife, who carried his arms and garments. And he discovered a chariot, harnessed with a chestnut horse that had but one leg, the pole passing through its body and out at the forehead. Within sat a woman, her eyebrows red and a crimson mantle around her. A very big man walked alongside, also in a coat of crimson, carrying a forked staff of hazelwood and driving a cow. Cahoolan claimed the cow as his own. The woman challenged him, and Cahoolan then demanded to know why she was speaking instead of the big man. The woman sang at him a song of challenge and insult. He prepared to spring, but in an instant, horse, woman, chariot, man, and cow had disappeared, and on the branch of a tree was a black bird. "A dangerous, enchanted woman you are," said Cahoolan to the black bird, for he now realized that she was the battle goddess Morrigan. "If I had only known that it was you, we would not have parted thus." "What you have done," replied the bird, "will bring you ill luck." "You cannot harm me," said Cahoolan. "Certainly I can," said the woman. "I am guarding your deathbed, and I shall be guarding it henceforth." Then the enchantress told him that she was taking the cow from the fairy hill of Cruachan to be bred by the bull of the big man, and when her calf was a year old, Cahoolan would die. She herself would come against him when he would be engaged at a certain ford with a man.
"I will become an eel," she said, "and I will throw a noose around thy feet in the ford."
Cahoolan exchanged threats with her, and she disappeared into the ground. But the following year, at the foretold foray at the ford, he overcame her and actually lived to die another day. A curious, perhaps playful echo of the symbolism of salvation in a yonder world dimly sounds in the final passage of the Pueblo folk tale of Water Jar Boy.
And down in the well are a lot of women, all the boys' aunts and cousins, and they're so glad to see their child. And he then goes back to the town, tells his mother that he has found his father. And he says, I can't stay here. I'm not going to live here. I'm going back to my father.
Then his mother got sick and died. The boy said to himself, "No use for me to live with these people." So he left them and went to the spring. And there was his mother. That was the way he and his mother went to live with his father. His father was Avayopi, water snake red. He said he could not live with them over at Sikyatki. That was the reason he made the boy's mother sick, so she died, and came over here to live with me, said the father. Now we will all live here together, said Avayo to his son. That's the way that boy and his mother went to the spring to live there.
The virgin birth, the crucifixion, the atonement with the father, the assumption of the virgin, not to a heavenly home, but to a subterranean one, which is the way of the earlier mythologies, where it's the abyssal water that fecundates the goddess rather than the heavenly waters.
This story, like that of the clam wife, repeats point for point a mythical narrative.
Dissolutions, the final phase of the cosmogonic cycle. And the fourth stage of the cycle, dissolutions, tells of the foretold end first of the hero, then of the manifested world. The end of the microcosm. The mighty hero of extraordinary powers is each of us. Not the physical self visible in the mirror, but the king within. Krishna declares, "I am the self seated in the hearts of all creatures. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings." This precisely is the sense of the prayers for the dead at the moment of personal dissolution, that the individual should now return to his pristine knowledge of the world-creative divinity who during life was reflected within his heart. This idea is sounded already in the coffin texts of ancient Egypt, where the dead man sings of himself as one with God. "I am Atum, I who was alone. I am Re at his first appearance. I am the great God, self-generator, who fashioned his names, Lord of gods, whom none approaches among the gods. I was yesterday, I know tomorrow. The battlefield of the gods was made when I spoke. I know the name of that great god who is therein. Praise of Re is his name. I am that great phoenix which is in Heliopolis." But the power to make a full transit back through the epochs of emanation depends on the character of the man when he was alive. The myths tell of a dangerous journey of the soul with obstacles to be passed. The Eskimos in Greenland enumerate a boiling kettle, a pelvis bone, a large burning lamp, monster guardians, and two rocks that strike together and open again. Such elements are standard features of world folklore and heroic legend. They have received their most elaborate and significant development in the mythology of the soul's last journey. An Aztec prayer to be said at the deathbed warns the departed of the dangers along the way back to the skeleton god of the dead. The Aztec ancients and officials prepared the body for the funeral, and when they had properly wrapped it, took a little water and poured it on the head, saying to the deceased, "This thou didst enjoy when thou wert living in the world." And they took a small jug of water and presented it to him, saying, "Here is something for thy journey." They set it in the fold of his shroud. Then they wrapped the deceased in his blankets, secured him strongly, and placed before him one at a time certain papers that had been prepared. "Lo, with this thou wilt be able to go between the mountains that clash. With this thou wilt pass along the road where the serpent watcheth. This will satisfy the little green lizard, Sonchitonal. And behold, with this thou wilt make the transit of the eight deserts of freezing cold. Here is that by which thou wilt survive the wind of the obsidian knives." The departed was to take a little dog with him, of bright reddish hair. Around its neck they placed a soft thread of cotton. They killed it and cremated it with the corpse. The departed swam on this small animal when he passed the river of the underworld, and, after 4 years of passage, he arrived with it before the god, to whom he presented his papers as gifts, whereupon he was admitted, together with his faithful companion, to the ninth abyss. The Chinese tell of a crossing of the fairy bridge under guidance of the jade maiden and the golden youth.
The Hindus picture a towering firmament of heavens and a many-leveled underworld of hells. Dante's Divine Comedy is an exhaustive review of the stages. Inferno, the misery of the spirit bound to the prides and actions of the flesh. Purgatorio, the process of transmuting fleshly into spiritual experience. Paradiso, the degrees of spiritual realization. A deep and awesome vision of the journey is that of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The man or woman who has died is identified with and actually called Osiris. The Book of the Dead was buried with the mummy as a guidebook to the perils of the difficult way, and chapters were recited at the time of burial. In the chapter of beating back the crocodile, "Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the west. Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the south. Get thee back, O crocodile that dwellest in the north. The things which are created are in the hollow of my hand, and those which have not yet come into being are in my body. I am clothed and wholly provided with thy magical words, O Re, the which are in heaven above me and in the earth beneath me." The chapter of driving away the slaughterings which are performed in the underworld gives the following. "My hair is the hair of Nu, my face is the face of the disk. My eyes are the eyes of Hathor, my ears are the ears of Apuat, my nose is the nose of Khentikas, my lips are the lips of Anpu, my teeth are the teeth of Serget, my neck is the neck of the divine goddess Isis, my hands are the hands of Ba Nebtatu, my forearms are the forearms of Neith, the lady of Sais, my backbone is the backbone of Suti, my phallus is the phallus of Osiris. My loins are the loins of the Lord of Keraba. My chest is the chest of the Mighty One of Terror. There is no member of my body that is not the member of some god. The god Thoth shieldeth my body altogether, and I am Re. Day by day I shall not be dragged back by the arms, and none shall lay violent hold upon my hands." The soul comes to the fullness of its stature and power through assimilating the deities that formerly had been thought to be separate from and outside of it. They are all projections of its own being, and as it returns to its true state, they are all reassumed. And then we come to the great culmination, the chapter of coming forth by day in the underworld, wherein the soul and the universal being are known to be one. "I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And I have the power to be born a second time. I am the divine hidden soul who createth the gods. Hail ye two hawks who are perched upon your resting places, who hearken unto the things which are said by him, who guide the fire to the hidden place, who lead along Re, and who follow him into the uppermost place of the shrine which is in the celestial heights. Hail, Lord of the shrine, which standeth in the middle of the earth. He is I, and I am he, and Ptah hath covered his sky with crystal." The end of the macrocosm. As the created form of the individual must dissolve, so that of the universe also.
And now we come to a very important theological point. In all of these systems, the flood comes automatically because the world is declining in virtue. The world declines in virtue automatically, and then comes the flood. Whereas in the exoteric reading of the Bible, it says that man became wicked and God in wrath sent the flood. That's a totally different theology. One is a theology of automatic, impersonal round. There is going to be the flood every, 25,920 years. The other says the flood comes when man sins and God gets angry. Both theologies are implicit in the book of Genesis. And I just leave that as a little theological meditation for anybody who likes to puzzle himself.
The Mayan version of the world end is represented in an illustration covering the last page of the Dresden Codex. Here we see the rain serpent stretching out across the sky, belching forth torrents of water. Great streams of water gush from the sun and moon. The old goddess, she of the tiger claws and forbidding aspect, the malevolent patroness of floods and cloudbursts, overturns the bowl of the heavenly waters. The crossbones, dread symbol of death, decorate her skirt, and a writhing snake crowns her head. Below, with downward pointed spear, symbolic of the universal destruction, the black god stalks abroad, a screeching owl raging on his fearsome head. Here indeed is portrayed with graphic touch the final all-engulfing cataclysm.
In dealing with archetypes, there are two orders of archetype. They're the archetypes in mythology that do stem from human nature and might emerge independently in various civilizations. And if you find a cluster of these, it does not follow that we have had a diffusion from one zone to another. But there are certain other types of recurrent motif that can hardly be explained in terms of spontaneous psychological imagery. Jung makes a great deal of the psychological, as all psychologists do. They interpret mythology in psychological terms, and the symbols that occur frequently everywhere they regard as coming from the psyche. In India, the idea of the cosmic cycle, the coming and going of the universe, is of what is called a yuga, a mahayuga, a great eon. And this lasts for 4,320,000 years. It falls into four stages, well, corresponding to the classical gold, silver, bronze, and iron, of declining spiritual energy. The last, called the Kali Yuga, lasts 432,000 years. A Babylonian priest of the 3rd century B.C. named Berossus was talking about the ages of the world in the old Sumero-Babylonian system. The great city of Kish, according to this, was the first city to which kingship came from above, the divine authority installed the first kings in Kish. And there were 10 kings ruling in Kish before the deluge came, which is the counterpart of the end of the world. And these 10 kings ruled for 432,000 years. Now, when you turn to the Germanic Eddas and read about Wotan, you find that in his warrior hall, Valhall, there are 540 doors. And at the day of the wolf, the day of the end of the eon, there will go through each of those doors to give battle to the anti-gods. There will go 800 warriors through each door.
One of the strongest representations appears in the poetic Edda of the ancient Vikings. Odin, the chief of the gods, has asked to know what will be the doom of himself and his pantheon, and the wise woman, a personification of the world mother herself, lets him hear. Brothers shall fight and fell each other, and sisters' sons shall kinship stain. Hard is it on earth with mighty whoredom. Axe time, sword time, shields are sundered, wind time, wolf time, ere the world falls. Nor ever shall men each other spare. The dog Garm at the cliff cave, the entrance to the world of the dead, shall open his great jaws and howl. The earth shall tremble, the crags and trees be torn asunder, the sea gush forth from the land. The fetters of those monsters who were chained back in the beginning shall all burst. Fenris Wolf shall run free and advance with lower jaw against the earth, upper against the heavens. Fires shall blaze from his eyes and nostrils. The world-enveloping serpent of the cosmic ocean shall rise in giant wrath and advance beside the wolf upon the land, blowing venom, so that it shall sprinkle all the air and water. Odin shall advance against the wolf, Thor against the serpent, Tyr against the dog, the worst monster of all, and Freyr against Surt, the man of flame. Thor shall slay the serpent, stride 10 paces from that spot, and because of the venom blown, fall dead to the earth. Odin shall be swallowed by the wolf, and thereafter Vidar, setting 1 foot upon the lower jaw, shall take the upper jaw of the wolf in his hand and tear asunder the gullet. Loki shall slay Heimdall and be slain by him. Surt shall cast fire over the earth and burn all the world. The sun turns black, Earth sinks in the sea. The hot stars down from heaven are swirled. Fierce grows the steam and the life-feeding flame till fire leaps high about heaven itself. Now Garm howls loud before Napalhir. The fetters will burst, the wolf run free. Much do I know and more can see of the fate of the gods, the mighty in flight.
And as Jesus sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming, and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered them, saying, Nation shall rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, and pestilences, and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall many betray one another, and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall arise, and shall deceive many. And because antiquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end shall come. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Wherever the poetry of myth is interpreted as biography, history, or science, it is killed. It is never difficult to demonstrate that as science and history, mythology is absurd. When a civilization begins to interpret its mythology in this way, the life goes out of it. Temples become museums, and the link between the two perspectives is dissolved. To bring the images back to life, one has to seek not interesting applications to modern affairs, but illuminating hints from the inspired past. The tribal ceremonies of birth, initiation, marriage, burial, installation serve to translate the individual's life crises and life deeds into classic, impersonal terms. They disclose him to himself. Not as this personality or that, but as the warrior, the bride, the widow, the priest, the chieftain. Rites of initiation and installation, then, teach the lesson of the essential oneness of the individual and the group. Seasonal festivals open a larger horizon. As the individual is an organ of society, so is the tribe or city, so is humanity entire, only a phase of the mighty organism of the cosmos. It has been customary to describe the seasonal festivals of so-called native peoples as efforts to control nature. This is a misrepresentation. The dominant motive in all truly religious ceremony is that of submission to the inevitables of destiny, and in the seasonal festivals, this motive is particularly apparent. No tribal rite has yet been recorded which attempts to keep winter from descending. On the contrary, the rites all prepare the community to endure, together with the rest of nature, the season of the terrible cold. And in the spring, the rites do not seek to compel nature to pour forth immediately corn, beans, and squash for the lean community. On the contrary, the rites dedicate the whole people to the work of nature's season. The wonderful cycle of the year with its hardships and periods of joy is celebrated and delineated and represented as continued in the life round of the human group. Many other symbolizations of this continuity fill the world of the mythologically instructed community. For example, the clans of the American hunting tribes commonly regarded themselves as descended from half-animal, half-human ancestors. These ancestors fathered not only the human members of the clan, but also the animal species after which the clan was named.
Let me tell you a little American Indian myth from the Blackfoot Indians, which tell us something about the animal master and his character. One of the techniques for gaining plenty of meat that the American Indians used, and that was used also in the great hunt of ancient Paleolithic Asia, was to drive an animal herd, scare an animal herd, over the edge of a precipice. A precipice would be found, which would be good for this kind of work. Then the herd would be sort of herded toward that, and they'd fall over. This was called an animal fall. Well, in the case of this particular story, the animals would not go over the fall. They would go to it and then break off, and they were getting no, the tribe was getting no buffalo, and they thought they might have to starve. Winter was coming on, and there was no meat, no food. Get a sense of the precarious lives of these early societies. One morning, a young girl gets up early, goes to the well to get water for the family breakfast or whatnot, and she sees a herd right up there, right on the edge. And she says, "Oh, if you would only jump over the cliff, I would marry one of you." Well, what do you know? Over they came, the whole thing like a storm, and breaking their backs and groaning and falling down. And one great big bucko comes over and he says, "Okay, girlie, fine." Oh, she says, "Oh, no." And, you know, surprise, the whole thing is surprising. And he said, "But look, this was the, here are all my relatives and friends smashed up here, and you're backing down like this, you come on." You never know when you're reading these stories whether it's an animal or a human being. This is the semi-animal, semi-human. Now, he was the shaman of that whole thing, and it was he who sent them over. That's the animal master. He's shamanistic. So he runs off with the girl. Well, the family wakes up a little later, and they say, "Well, where's Minnehaha?" You know, and you know how Indians are, though. They just look at the footprints, and you get the whole story. So Dad goes out, and he looks at the footprints, and he sort of, he sees that buffalo, and he sees all the dead buffalo, and he gets the point. So he goes in, puts on his walking moccasins, and gets his bow and arrow and all that kind of stuff, and he starts out after Minnehaha, and he's sniffing his way along. And he comes to a buffalo wallow. Now, that's a nice dusty place where the buffalo like to roll around and get the fleas off and things like that. And this is buffalo country. So he sits down and thinks, tries to think up a plan of campaign. And while he's sitting there, a magpie comes. Now, magpies are wonderful, smart birds, and they play the role of trickster, hero, and shaman bird. So he says to the magpie, "Have you seen my daughter around here? She ran off with a buffalo." And the magpie says, "Well, there's a herd just down the way there, and I saw a young girl there. She's probably your daughter." "Well," says the father, "will you just tell her that her father is here?" And the magpie says, "Okay, I'll do that." So the magpie goes over, and he pretends to be picking around near the girl. He moves up to her, and he says, "Your father's over there by the wallow." And and she says, "Oh, dear, this is terrible. You tell him to wait. This is very dangerous. I'll try to get in touch with him." So back goes the magpie with the message. Now, the old buffalo is asleep, as buffaloes usually are, and she's sitting there doing her knitting or whatnot with all these sleeping buffaloes. And then the old boy wakes up. He says, "Go over to the well and get me some water." Bing! And he busts off a horn, hands it to her, and she goes with the buffalo horn to get a bit of water. So she goes, and she says, "Daddy, this is real dangerous. Those fellows are going to kill you." He says, "Come on, I don't want you with all those buffaloes." Well, she says, "You wait a minute, I'll work this thing out. This is not going to be easy." So she goes back with the buffalo horn full of water, and the old man takes it, and he goes, and he says, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Indian," something like that. And she says, "Nothing of the kind." It's the same mythology, that's why I'm using these things. And she's very nervous, but he lets out a buffalo roar. All the buffaloes wake up, and now it's time to go on the warpath, so they all start doing a buffalo dance. She looks on in amazement. And then they go over to the buffalo wallow and they dance Daddy to death. They just trample him down so there's no Daddy left, and Minnehaha is crying there. So the old buffalo looks at her and he says, so you're sad, you're crying, your daddy's dead. But think of all our relatives, dead, 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 all over the place as a result of the works of your tribe. Well, she says, oh, but he's my daddy, and I do want him back. Well, says the buffalo, and here's the beginning of a very important theme. If you can bring your daddy back to life, I'll let you and him go. So she says to the magpie, do you think you could find a little bit of daddy over there? Just any little bit of bone would be okay. And the magpie goes and picks around, and he does indeed find one of the vertebrae and brings it to the girl. Now what she does is put that vertebra down, put her blanket over it, and start singing a magical song. This is this idea, there is no death now if you perform the rites properly. She presently brings it about that there is daddy lying there under the blanket. She lifts the blanket, peeks, he's there, all right, but he isn't living yet. So she goes on with the song, and presently the blanket moves and up sits daddy. Well, all the buffalo are very much exercised about this and very much excited about it. And they say to her, why don't you do this for us? And so they said, here's the way to do it now. We get the idea. And they taught the buffalo dance to the girl and her father. And they went back as the messengers of this covenant with the animals. This is the basic myth of hunting cultures. A covenant between the human society and the animal society, based on the principle that the animals will offer their bodies provided a ritual is performed, returning their blood to the source, mother soil, from which they will be born again. The same animals come back. They're not different animals. They're the same animals, just as the same daddy came back. If the proper rite is performed, they can give their body time and time and time again. So that when one is being initiated into the lore of the hunt, this lore includes not only how to use weapons, string a bow and let an arrow fly, but also how to perform the rite that will make it, bring it about that there should be animals present. And any failure of animal herds to appear is attributed to a failure of some kind in the rites. The Buffalo Society of the Blackfeet Indians were the protectors of this ritual. And we have paintings by Catlin and so forth, of these buffalo dances, where the dancers wear buffalo heads, imitating the buffalo in this little dialogue. This is a basic hunting rite, the notion of animal masters and the notion of the covenant. The notion also of adventurers and adventures through whom or through which the rite is brought from the animal world. It's given by the animals themselves. This myth seems to me a very important one.
Thus, the human members of the clan were blood cousins of the species and in turn protected by the animal wisdom of the wood folk. Or another example, the hogan, or mud hut, of the Navajos of New Mexico and Arizona is constructed on the plan of the Navajo image of the cosmos. The entrance faces east. The eight sides represent the four directions and the points between. Every beam and joist corresponds to an element in the great hogan of the all-embracing earth and sky. And since the soul of man itself is regarded as identical in form with the universe, the mud hut is a representation of the basic harmony of man and the world, and a reminder of the hidden lifeway of perfection. The hero today. All of which is very far indeed from the contemporary view. For the democratic ideal of the self-determining individual, the invention of the power-driven machine, and the development of the scientific method of research have so transformed human life that the long-inherited, timeless universe of symbols has collapsed. It is not only that there is no hiding place for the gods from the searching telescope and microscope. There is no such society anymore as the gods once supported. The problem of humankind today, therefore, is precisely the opposite to that of men in the comparatively stable periods of those great coordinating mythologies which now are known as lies. The hero deed to be wrought is not today what it was in the century of Galileo. Where then there was darkness, now there is light, but also where light was, there now is darkness. The modern hero deed must be that of questing to bring to light again the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. Not the animal world, not the plant world, not the miracle of the spheres, but humanity itself is now the crucial mystery. It is not society that is to guide and save the creative hero, but precisely the reverse. And so every one of us shares the supreme ordeal, carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in the bright moments of our tribe's great victories, but in the silences of our personal despair.
This has been an Audio Renaissance presentation.